WSLR-LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV-LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at wslr.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. Take it for granted that public schools should be free and available to everyone because it's essential for a democratic society and a modern economy. Thomas Jefferson envisioned a meritocracy based on universal education, but white supremacy was baked into that package and has influenced the education system ever since. In her new book, Original Sins, The Miseducation of Black and Native Children and the Construction of American Racism, Eve L. Ewing looks at how schools built the infrastructure of racial inequality in the U.S. Eve, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
What were Jefferson's views on race that has shaped our educational system?
Sure. Well, Jefferson really believed in some core ideas that he outlined in a number of texts, including Notes on the State of Virginia, which is not as well known by folks as the Declaration of Independence, but in many ways is just as influential. To put it briefly, he believed that among white folks that there should be an egalitarian opportunity for the most talented people to rise through the ranks and get a great public education to become the leaders of a free and democratic society. But he also believed that black people and native people were inherently less intelligent, inherently less capable, inherently barbaric, and that they were not able to engage in sophisticated thought or cognition in the way that other human beings could. And he also thought that Native people were doomed to disappearance, that it was very sad, it was very tragic, but they were eventually going to be completely gone from the face of the United States, and took no real culpability or accountability for that, even though his own policies within his own lifetime contributed to that mightily. But yeah, those are some of his key ideas. And I think it's important to talk about them, not just because Thomas Jefferson was any thinker, but because his ideas were really important in framing the architecture of the Republic of what we now call the United States.
Black education in the United States didn't become widespread until after Reconstruction or during Reconstruction. What was the focus of education for the newly freed slaves during Reconstruction?
It's a really complicated and interesting historic moment because on the one hand, you saw formerly enslaved people really seeing and understanding education as a pathway to their freedom, as a pathway to liberation. As many folks know, it was illegal for enslaved people to read and to write. And because folks could use the ability to read and write to literally write freedom passes, education represented a form of liberation, not only spiritually, intellectually, but also in a very literal material sense. And at the same time, during Reconstruction, we saw the advancement of an agenda within some of these schools that was really intended to teach black people a set of ideas that would make sure that they remained subservient after they were no longer legally enslaved. And so there were folks that were former Confederate leaders, former slaveholders, and then also some well-intentioned abolitionists from the North who really made it their business to say the most important thing that a black person can learn is to be obedient, is to be meek, gentle, and mild, is to never raise their hand in vengeance against their former enslaver. And if you think about it, this was an important set of ideas for them because in a lot of these places, formerly enslaved black people grossly outnumbered their former enslavers. And also, there was an economy in the South that relied entirely on their labor, and that labor could no longer legally be forced and coerced in the same way. So they had to find other methods of coercion, other methods of persuasion, in addition to things like vagrancy laws and the architecture of incarceration that arose around the South around that time. We also saw education, and specifically, I would say, schooling playing a role in normalizing that idea of subservience.
In the book, I think you mentioned this statistics that at one point 90% of the people in prison in Florida were black.
If you're reading it, I believe you. I'm not going to pull it up in front of you, but yes, yes.
That's just incredible. So it was basically slavery by another means.
Well, and we've seen amazing writing on this from other writers, most famously Michelle Alexander in her book, The New Jim Crow. But if you look at the roles of not only prisons, but also things like penal farms, quarries, those images of the chain gang. If you've seen the movie Sinners recently, there's a moment when they're driving down the Mississippi Country Road and we see a group of men that are all shackled together on this chain gang. And it's important to understand that those folks, they were being punished. They were being held in confinement. But at the same time, they were also building up the infrastructure of the South. And so the economy benefited and stole from the work of these incarcerated folks, even though they were not enslaved. And so things like roads, things like railroads, things like swamps and forests being cleared, a lot of that work was done by incarcerated people. And a lot of those people were children. They were young. So yeah, many folks would say slavery under another name. And there are some statistics that suggest that those experiences were even more violent, even more lethal than they had been during slavery, because if you're the property of the state and your job is to just be out here pounding rocks in the hot sun all day, nobody owns you. Nobody loses money if you die. Nobody loses money if you starve. During slavery, obviously, enslavement is horrific. And at the same time, if you're owned by a person, they have a financial incentive to protect their investment, to put it crassly. And there's some quotations that I include in the book of folks saying, if somebody died on the chain gang, if somebody died on the penal farm, you just go out and arrest somebody else for public vagrancy. And so it's truly, truly a tragic time. And we can see the echoes of that today in the incredibly unfair conditions that we see around labor for incarcerated people, firefighting and wildfires and things like that.
Now let's take a look at the education of Native children. What's settler colonialism and how does this differ from the picture that children are taught in schools about the founding of America?
Yeah, thank you for that wonderful question, because I'm a professor and I used to be a middle school teacher, so I think it's always important to just take time to define things. And so some of us, when we were raised in school and we think about what the colonists are, what colonialism is you think of folks being sent from a European country to the United States, to other parts of what was referred to as the New World. And the narrative that we're told is that they were brave heroes, they were adventurers, they were pioneers of a new land, and they had it hard, but they were fighting for their individual freedoms and having this tenacious life with their families and Little House on the Prairie and the Pilgrims, and that these are stories and images that are very important to what we might consider the creation myth, the story that we're told as children, and often invited to act out that story, to role play, to dress up as pilgrims, to dress up as people living out on the prairie. And what is erased from that story is the fact that this was a land that was already occupied by many, many people since time immemorial, many different tribal nations, many different Native folks. And so what settler colonialism is, it's exactly that. It's the idea that you bring new folks from a different country, a different colonial power, to a new place, and they don't simply represent an outpost of the original country. They erase the story of what was there. They destroy the story of what was there. They replace it with something new. And then they act as though the previous thing never existed. And so it's not simply that folks were coming in and quote unquote looking for a new life. It's that the way we are told the story of the beginning of the United States, the origin story of this land, acts as though nobody was ever here. And this image of folks coming to what is considered terra nullius, empty land. And we see that in the United States. We see that in Canada. We see that in South Africa. We see that in occupied Palestine. We see that in Australia. The story that there are folks who come here and say, this is our land. This has always been our land. This land belongs to us. And that, in short, is what settler colonialism is. And I keep saying the word story and the word narrative because it's a really important part of this. It's not just that folks engage in this kind of warfare with guns or with disease, but they also engage in it with a story. In telling the story, this is where this country begins, and acting like people who were here before simply never existed. There's a great power in that. And that idea of disappearance that I mentioned that was so important to Thomas Jefferson, that's one of the ways that idea gets normalized, is that we see Native people not only being disappeared from the land, but disappeared from our stories of how we talk about this land. And even something like the song, This Land Is Your Land, is an example of that. And so that's my short version on what settler colonialism is.
The amount of violence that went into settler colonialism, because slavery, genocide, it really is the basis for the whole economy of the U.S. I have to ask this more as a personal thing. My grandson, they were doing a chapter on the mission system in California.
Oh, we talk about that a little bit. Yeah.
And I know a little bit about the history of the mission system, and it's just horrific. And the version that my grandson was taught was so whitewashed. And I think he was like 11 years old. What age do you think it's appropriate to start telling children the truth? Because part of me was, I want to really tell him what was going on. Yeah, but do you tell an 11-year-old kid that this is based on genocide?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, Marianne. And I want to take a second and just explain for listeners that might not be familiar with California and the mission system a little bit about what you're talking about, because this mission project, as it's often called, is really ubiquitous in a lot of schools in California. And I write about it a little bit in the book. Basically, a lot of folks are more familiar with colonial forces from England and from other parts of Europe. But in California and many other parts of North America, we know that there were also Spanish colonizers. And one of the things that they did was they built these Catholic missions, which were both religious and military outposts that, as you say, were sites of incredible violence, that were genocidal sites. And what the mission project asks young people to do in elementary school classrooms, often in about fourth or fifth grade, like it sounds like your grandson was in, is to build their own little mission out of popsicle sticks or out of Legos or Lincoln Logs or things like that. And it turns this, as you put it, really horrific genocidal story into a kind of play acting where we are asking young people to occupy the character of colonial violence. We are not only telling them this story, but we're telling them who the hero of the story is. We're asking them to take on the role of the colonizer. It's a really prime example of how, before we even get to what's appropriate and what do we talk about and not, that right now the choice that's being made is to talk about these violent histories, but in a way where we're asking kids to take on the persona of the violent actor. There's an amazing scholar who's a friend of mine who I cite in the book, whose name is Harper Keenan, who actually did a really great textbook analysis of the way that the mission system and the way that colonialism in California is talked about in textbooks. And he found that in real life, according to historians, there were far, far, far more examples of Spanish colonizers initiating violence against Native people. That in reality, that's what happened more often. But in the textbook, the reverse was true, that there were far, far more discussions about violence of Native people against colonizers. And it perpetuates this idea of barbarism, of savagery, of, well, you know, we just had to do this. But I want to then turn to your question about, okay, well, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate? And I think it's a really tough question. It's one I think about all the time. I used to be a middle school teacher, and I also think about it with other young people that I'm in relation with in my community and my family. And here's the thing. I think it's always appropriate to tell kids the truth. I think that what that truth looks like, how you tell the truth, the tone you use, the details you use, the age-appropriate and developmentally appropriate analogies you use, that's the important question. I talk about this a lot in the book as it pertains to Christopher Columbus, where kids are learning about Christopher Columbus when they are 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old in preschool. And the way they learn about it is so inaccurate and so sanitized. And it's often kind of devoid of real educational content. And I say that in most of these activities, Christopher Columbus could pretty much be swapped out with Santa Claus. He's almost mythical. The activity is cut out a construction paper version of Columbus's hat and wear it. Okay, well, like, why is that important? What are we learning from that? If we're just learning cutting and using glue and construction paper, there are probably other ways that we can do that. And there are so many horrific atrocities in the world. We think about the Holocaust in Germany, in Europe. We think about people like Pol Pot and Cambodian genocide. We think about the Rwandan genocide. All of these awful stories of atrocities. And let me tell you what we don't do. We don't say, let's teach kids a little bit about this in kindergarten and a little bit in fourth and fifth grade, and let's pretend that these horrible people who did horrible things were actually good, and let's turn them into a coloring book page, and let's turn them into a popsicle stick craft. We either wait until we feel like we can talk to kids about some of those details that are really tough but are real. Kids all over the country learn about Anne Frank, and they learn about the Holocaust through the Diary of Anne Frank or through Number the Star. stars through age-appropriate, developmentally appropriate literature and conversations with guidance and support from teachers and parents and community members. And we figure out ways to say, okay, it's important for us to start having this conversation. It's the beginning of a conversation, and we're going to continue to talk about it in different ways as you grow.
The Literacy Council of Sarasota is looking for adult volunteer tutors to help other adults improve their basic English communication and literacy skills. No previous experience required. Volunteers will receive training over 3 weekday sessions, Monday, June 9th, Wednesday, June 11th, and Friday, June 13th. Registration is required by May 31. More information is available by calling Susan Bergstrom at 941-955-0421 or by emailing sbergstrom@sarasotaliteracy.org. You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Eve L. Ewing. We're talking about her book, Original Sins, The Miseducation of Black and Native Children and the Construction of American Racism. We were discussing how difficult topics like genocide are taught to children.
What we don't do is have kids make a construction paper Hitler project when they're in second or third grade and then say, oh, well, what? You know, you want me to tell them the truth about Hitler? It's too violent. That's not appropriate. Of course it's not appropriate. But the opposite thing is also not appropriate. And that's really, in so many cases, the way we talk about these genocidal settler colonial figures now is through this version that asks our kids to take on the persona of horrible people instead of saying, let's wait and let's talk about this in an age-appropriate way at different phases. And I feel very strongly that that is intentional. And it's intentional because that violence against Indigenous people is not a one-time event. It's not something that just happened once and it was really sad. We live and work and talk and breathe and move on stolen Indigenous land. And that theft, as long as that land is not returned, as long as that land is not returned to the stewardship of the people who lived here initially, that theft is an ongoing process. The land is still stolen. And so that's a really uncomfortable fact. And it's a fact that flies directly in the face of what we like to tell ourselves about the United States, that it's a fair and just land where all men are created equal and we all pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and earn everything we've got. And so it's important for us to tell these stories in school because they make us feel better. They make us feel better about that ongoing theft. And so it's, to me, it's quite intentional that we're asking kids to take on the role of Columbus, to take on the role of the folks building the missions in California, to celebrate these quote unquote heroes and explorers and pioneers, regardless of how violent they may have been or the impact that their actions may have been. And the purpose of that is a justification, it's normalization of a violence that is ongoing.
How has the concept of race changed over time? There was a definite economic reason for both the way that Blacks and Natives were dealt in the United States. But there was a whole bunch of people who came in who were initially not considered white.
Right. I teach about race a lot. And the thing that I always tell my students, I sound like a broken record because I say it basically once a week, is that the concept of race is historically contingent, politically contingent, geographically contingent, and that we are taught that Black is Black, Native is Native, white is white. But in fact, these are categories that are created before the arrival of violent settlers and settler colonialism in what is currently referred to as the United States. Haudenosaunee people and folks on the Pueblo and Seminole people and Yurok people that are all now considered to be under this category of Native, or in many parts of history, and a term that some people would still use now, is Indian or American Indian. But prior to a group of what we now call white folks arriving and saying, hey, you guys are all the same, those are different groups of people. And we see the same thing in thinking about the case of enslavement, that the category of Black is a category that is invented partially as a means of lumping together a whole group of people that, again, have different faith practices, different languages, come from different regions. I was fortunate enough to visit Senegal and Gorée Island in the Maison des Esclaves, the House of Slaves, recently. And one of the questions that a tourist asked was, well, why didn't people get together and fight back? And why didn't they overthrow the folks that had kidnapped them? And there are many complicated reasons for that. But one reason is that people didn't speak the same language. They came from all these different places. It is once they arrived on these shores that they become umbrellaed together under the category of Black. And that serves a political purpose. It serves the purpose of creating a new category of people that you get to say is a subhuman category. And so we see the same thing as you're pointing out with the history of white people, that folks know about those famous signs, no Blacks, no dogs, no Irish, and the many ways in which Irish people were discriminated against. At some points, German people were discriminated against in this country, Italian people, folks from Eastern Europe discriminated against and also treated with anti-Semitism. And it is only through social movement over time, and I think about it like the movement of tectonic plates under the earth, that all of those different folks get lumped together under the category of whiteness. There are many different theories for the ways that this happens, but one of the things that W.E.B. Du Bois writes about in his book Black Reconstruction is that he writes about the idea of what he calls the wages of whiteness. And he says that if you think about the South, during slavery, not all white people, and in fact, not even the majority of white people, owned slaves. Slaves were a form of property, a form of wealth that not everybody had. And so he says, if you think about it, it would have been more logical when slavery ended after emancipation for poor white people that didn't have a lot of resources, didn't have a lot of land, and were themselves being abused and taken advantage of, exploited by the aristocratic class, they could have joined together with formerly enslaved people and said, hey, you know, let's take political power, let's work together, let's be allied. And he said the reason they didn't do that is what he calls the wage of whiteness. And he says, being white, the idea that of whiteness pays a psychological wage. So it allowed these folks that maybe didn't have a lot to eat, maybe didn't have a great place to live, to look around and say, well, I'm still better than that person over there. I'm still better than that Black person over there, because look at that judge. He looks like me. Look at that sheriff. He looks like me. Look at that person who owns the store and who owns this land. That person looks like me. I'm like him. I'm just like him. I'm not like those other people over there. And in the United States, where we have this incredibly strong narrative of personal individual uplift and a kind of moral virtue that is ascribed to wealth, that it feels good for people to think that they are, they say, down on their luck millionaires. And so that's part of how whiteness is created, through this myth of telling folks, hey, you have a shared interest with that guy down the road that actually makes way more money than you. And we see this playing out in contemporary American politics. We see people who, in terms of their material circumstances, really could use some health care, really could use some child care, really could use some quality housing and mental health treatment and substance abuse treatment and all these things. And we see folks voting against that because they are told that they should ally themselves politically with someone who perhaps, in fact, doesn't have a whole lot in common with them. But if you say, hey, you know, me and you are just the same, and the real enemy is that undocumented person over there, or that Muslim person over there, or that Black person over there, you can get pretty far politically, as it turns out. And so that is a very old idea, and it's one of the ways in which the category of whiteness brings together people that otherwise oftentimes really wouldn't have a lot in common.
So getting back to the schooling, when what we saw during Reconstruction was that the focus for a lot of the schools was teaching Black people that whatever you do, don't get angry and don't try to get revenge. What was the focus of the Native schools?
The story of Native schools in this country and in Canada is a tragedy. I mean, it's a tragedy and it's a crime. Beginning in the 19th century and lasting, many people say, well into the late 20th century, and with impacts that last for generations, Native children were forcibly taken from their parents, sometimes through direct force, sometimes through coercion, sometimes through starvation, sometimes as a political threat. They were taken from their parents and they were enrolled in boarding schools where they were often forbidden from speaking their native language, where they were often physically abused, where they were starved, where their hair was cut off, where they were isolated from their culture. And the very intentional practice behind this was to do what was called, quote unquote, killing the Indian to save the man. And so the idea was, and we see actually federal leaders in this country, people like Carl Schurz, people like Merrill Edwards Gates, these are folks that were at the head of federal government divisions that were in charge of Native affairs, saying things like, this is cheaper and more efficient than winning the quote unquote Indian War through guns and soldiers on the battlefield, that we will lose fewer lives and save more money if we win this war through teachers. And so they saw this act of kidnapping people's children and erasing in them all possible connection to the place that they came from and to their families as a means of warfare. They saw it intentionally as a genocidal act. And it was, unfortunately for many people, very effective, although we also have these incredible stories of resilience and resistance. And it was also a tool to manipulate their parents, saying, we have your kids essentially as hostages, and so don't rise up against us. The other thing is that in the same way that incarcerating Black people and putting them on the chain gang or putting them on the penal farm or on the quarry helped agriculturally develop the South, these children often were taken out of school on what was called the outing program. And what these outing programs were is they would take kids to quote-unquote school, and then they would send them to pick fruit from somebody's orchard or to work in a quarry or to work in manufacturing. Girls were sent to be domestic laborers in the houses of white families who sometimes wouldn't let them go back to school, to receive what paltry education they might have been receiving in the schooling space. And so one of the things I quote in the book that was just stunning to me was this newspaper article in which there was a proposal to build a native boarding school in a particular site, and it got moved to be closer to an orchard so that it could be a place that the kids would be taken to do agricultural labor, forced to do agricultural labor. And the locals celebrated it. They said, this is great. It's going to be so cheap to get these child workers. And so it's one of those one of the basic arguments of the book is that we have to understand schooling in order to understand the racial hierarchy of this country. You have to understand racial hierarchy in order to understand schooling. But these stories are about so much more than what happens in their classroom. It is about the very unjust foundations upon which the entire country is built.
And now we see the fight going to funding and what's appropriate to be taught in schools. And one of the things that you talk about in the book is the difference between the schools where the affluent white children go and how it encourages creativity and critical thinking. And then the majority Black schools are teaching discipline and teaching to the tests so that everything is uniform. How do we start turning this around, especially given the political climate now, where we have a whole lot of people who want to just completely deny the whole history of white supremacism in this country?
I think that it's in a really important time for us to be doing the work of dreaming. And I know that that sounds wild to be talking about dreaming and imagination when in many ways we are in really critical danger, that young people and adults, there are many folks in our communities whose lives are on the line. But the thing is that right now we are living inside somebody else's dream. This nightmare that we see unfolding in our schools and across the country, this is something that other folks dreamed up, strategized about, imagined. They got together and they were extremely organized in fighting and politically organizing to see what they want. The policies that we see unfolding now didn't come from nowhere. They came from a small group of dedicated people. And I've been saying everywhere I go, traveling across the country talking about this book, those people are not smarter than us. They're not better than us. They're not better looking than us. They're not more organized than us. And so how do we not only fight against the things that we don't like, but how do we spend time articulating what we do want? And how do we not wait? It is crucial that you do not wait until you see the first transphobic policy unfolding in your school. You do not wait until your principal is letting ICE through your door to take a kid away. You do not wait until they're saying, hey, we can't talk about Black history. The thing is we have to be as loud and as proactive in saying what we do want and what we do stand for, as these folks have been in calling for these things to be taken away. And so if you have a kid who's in a school, write a letter to your principal, get a group of folks together, show up at your school board meeting and say, hey, these are the values of our community, and it's really imperative. I want to know what you're doing to protect these values. What are you doing to protect trans kids right now? What are you doing to make sure that accurate history is being taught in our schools? Be loud, show up, get matching shirts. The same kind of organizing that we see these other groups doing, they don't have special secret sauce.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Eve L. Ewing, and her book is Original Sins, The Miseducation of Black and Native Children and the Construction of American Racism. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.